right. I appreciate you guys being on. This is River City Sounds history episode 2. I'm Cole. We also have some other people here with us. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves?
I'm Brianna.
I'm Zach. I've been doing some of the mixing on the last few episodes.
My name is Jono. I'm just the guy.
Like I said, I appreciate you guys being on. I invited you two on specifically just because of the subject matter we're doing today. I hope you guys could bring some light to it, because I don't know if I'm exactly 100% correct on some of these things. So I hope you guys can bring some light to it and also maybe make it more palatable to people who don't necessarily know all that much about music production, like Brianna here, and hopefully she'll be able to understand it. So you're going to play our Ben Kissel this evening.
I get to just be a person.
Yes, you're our person today. So yes, our special episode today is going to be on George Martin, not the writer, but the music producer of the Beatles. I actually did pull together some sources on this. We're doing The Long and Winding Road by Ted Greenwald, The Beatles, Every Little Thing by Maxwell McKenzie, The Little Book of Beatles, Quips and Quotes from the Fab Four by Sevenoaks Books, and then Meet the Beatles Again by Ken Sharp and Denny Sumach. So yeah, I've collected these books over the years, just every Christmas, birthday. My parents know what to get me, and they give me Beatles books. So they did come in useful, so I'd like to thank them for that. We're going to start off with a little bit of history about George Martin before we get into some of his contributions to the music industry, which I also can say were a huge influence on not only myself, but also how we do this podcast. So we'll kind of get into talking a little bit about that as well. So Sir George Henry Martin was born January 3rd, 1926. In Highbury, London, England. George's interest in music started when his family acquired a piano when he was 6 years old. In 1943, George would join the Air Fleet arm of the Royal Navy at the age of 17. Although he would never see combat, Martin would leave the army 4 years later in 1947 after becoming a commissioned officer and an aerial observer. He was basically an aerial reconnaissance. Martin would go on to use his veterans grant to attend the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, where he would meet his first wife, the two of whom married on his birthday in 1948. 2 years later, George would finish his schooling in 1950 and began working at the BBC's classical music department. Later that same year, George Martin joined EMI, an assistant to the head of the Parlophone Records. And yeah, I wanted to ask, Zach, since you read the script, did you do any little research on yourself, or did you just kind of get a gist of...
I'm doing it on the fly.
Okay. So Parliament started as a label for insignificant acts owned by EMI Studios. And in 1955, George Martin, who had replaced the previous head of Parlophone Records, and had begun recording classical, Baroque, and original cast recordings. But most notably at this time, Parlophone would be most well known for its comedy and novelty recordings, where he's going to learn some of his later tricks of the trade, like track cutting. Now, and the Bridge Over the River Kwai, which I mentioned to you earlier, Brianna, was a movie with Alec Guinness in it. Yes, I did. they were doing a spoof of it, basically. And due to legal reasons, George had to edit out the K for every Kwai and made it the Bridge Over River Y. And that's going to come into really use later when he's actually recording with the Beatles. In 1956, Martin had already auditioned and rejected a pop vocalist, Tommy Steele, who would later be signed to Decca the next day, making him an international star by the end of the year. A turning point in Martin's career where he'd start to want to redeem himself by looking for his own pop hit. So George Martin is going to meet the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, in early 1962, where talks begin about signing a band. Although Martin had not yet met or seen any of the musicians performed, Martin would sign them to a contract offering a penny to split amongst every band.
Ooh.
Sorry. And you guys can comment in between, make jokes, you don't got to be silent
this
there.
This is exciting.
Sorry.
About
okay. Martin, if you have anything to put in, please. One thing we are going to learn tangentially is going to be Brian Epstein, which we might do an episode on, is how he kind of fucked the Beatles royally, but it worked in their favor. If you guys weren't familiar with that.
I am not.
I think there's a comic. Shit, it might be called The Fifth Beatle. I'm not quite sure. But it's a comic basically evolving around Brian Epstein, and there's a good scene where him and the general, or was it the colonel? You know what I'm talking about?
Elvis's guy.
The
Colonel, yeah.
Yeah, how they basically met up, and the Colonel wanted to buy the Beatles from him, and they would get a lot more money, but Epstein was like, no, because he knew how to... He would undersell them, because... Going off a tangent now. Basically, when they signed up for the Ed Sullivan show.
Yeah.
He undercut them, and they would do free performances for one performance's pay. And basically, that was like his idea of like promotion was your pay kind of thing. And they didn't know about that.
But yeah, I mean, I guess they didn't really know what was going on. I mean, yeah, they didn't know what to expect at all.
They were getting scammed completely. Like.
Kind of, but like...
They figured it out eventually.
But, I mean, yeah, by 67, they were able to completely forgo playing live, and they made all of their money off of record sales. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know, contracts and shit like that, I don't...
Pay to play?
Yeah,
I don't
pay
know.
To play. Yeah, I don't want to get into that. So although EMI had previously rejected the Beatles, Martin, who was not a part of that decision, held off on signing the Penny contract himself until the band performed for him, saying that EMI had nothing to lose by signing them. However, by the release of From Me to You, Martin would have the royalty rate doubled, much to the displeasure of EMI, making him the traitor to EMI.
Two pennies. Wow.
So that's for each of them, I guess. Or is that from the split?
Well, what you read was split between the members.
Yeah. Hey, I'm just reading what was written.
Yeah. I heard the sources.
What were you going to say, Brianna?
I was going to say what you wrote. I'm assuming you're reading from your notes.
Yeah. No, and this is mostly written. That's kind of the problem with this, is that some of them I kind of wrote like notes to like talk about, and then there's just some part where it's just information. I'm just in information mode right now.
You got to get the bio out of the way.
Kind of, yeah. So by this time, the Beatles had famously... Sorry?
Nothing.
I just want everyone to talk. By this time, the Beatles had famously went around and been rejected by every record label available. Even Decca, who had famously stolen Martin's previous act, said of the Beatles in 1962, "We don't like their sound. Their guitar music is on the way out anyways." Oh my.
Was this...
Short-sighted.
Still in the period where they were playing live mostly in those like tinny speakers you've told me about?
This would kind of be before that, because the tinny speakers thing I told you about was like the stadium period where they're playing in...
I didn't know if they were using similar
America
equipment.
Well, I mean, I don't really know.
Shit sound.
Probably. While George Martin wasn't impressed with the Beatles' performance initially, his initial instinct was to sign them as a backing band for a frontman he had hoped to find later. But as the myth goes, a remark by Harrison about Martin's tie and the rest of the Beatles join in teasing Martin, leading the producer to want to sign the band on sheer wit alone. And as you guys might well know, the Beatles were, of course, well known for their interviews and their comedic remarks. So one thing that Martin would say about the role of a producer in this time period, he says he is more of a manager more than anything else. The word producer wasn't used. In that fact, my title was an A&R manager, the artist and repertoire. The job was basically to look after the artist and make sure that they were happy and looked after, and they were looked after in the studio, and give them advice about the music too, and make sure that engineer did his job, and it was kind of a general fixer. So that's kind of interesting, I thought, that it wasn't really the producer idea that we think of now.
Yeah. Especially not in the, now that we do a lot of digital, you know, electronic stuff and all that. But
yeah,
and that's and let's not forget that the Beatles at this point, they were like what, 20 years old maybe. I don't know exactly, but and they weren't experienced in the studio. So he's there, babysitting, making sure they stay on task. Because hey, we got 5 days to know. Less than that.
I mean, yeah, sometimes the earlier ones, they did it in one day.
That was, please me, they did in one day, right?
But I think Marcus Parks put it well, where it's like a producer is someone who can put four assholes in a room and make them work, in a way. You know what I mean? So one thing that definitely sets George Martin apart from other producers at this day was his classical arrangements that he contributed to the Beatles.
Yes.
First, most notable of which would be the arrangement for Yesterday, as well as the U.S. arrangement of Help. If you didn't know, the U.S. release of Help was actually half and half. Half of his songs and the other half were classical arrangements of the Beatles songs.
Oh.
So it made up the entire album, but only half of it were actually the Beatles. Because if you've actually seen the movie Help, which is god-awful.
Oh, I love it.
Really?
for how awful it is.
Okay, yeah, because it all revolves around like one of Ringo's rings, which he got somewhere, and they have to go to like Hawaii. They just wanted to take him to Hawaii, or
yeah, the plot is ridiculous.
It was an excuse for a vacation.
Yes, they basically, and apparently this, I'm pretty sure this is when they started smoking weed too. So that's why they said it is so just trash, because they were just smoking it up and just like going to a set and like, how can we make this part of the movie, and just shot something. But yeah, I think I'm pretty sure Help would be the last of this. The Beatles would release U.S. and U.K. releases. The U.K. releases are the ones that we generally accept as now, and they released like the Beatles' first album. It's what it's called in the U.K. in the U.S. And then we also get the other ones, the most infamous of which would be Yesterday and Today, the Butcher album. Yes. If you guys are familiar with that,
yeah.
And that will be kind of the last one of that era where it's the U.S. versus the U.K. releases. Yesterday and Today was actually all the songs that were left off of the other albums from that that they took off of the U.S. releases, basically.
And just in case you don't know what he means by Butcher album, they had an album cover, but underneath that album cover, if you peeled it back, there was a photo of the Beatles sitting around with parts of baby dolls and raw meat hanging over them at like a just a normal photo shoot.
Yeah. So yeah, that got taken off the market pretty quickly.
Yeah.
If you were lucky enough, you could get one of the ones that still had just the sticker plate pasted over the old one, so you could have both.
Yeah.
As opposed to it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, and you might actually be about to say this, that whole thing was in response to the alternate versions of their albums coming out in the U.S. Meaning Capitol Records butchered their albums.
I've not heard that, but I like that.
Yeah, you know, listener, double check me.
Okay, yeah, no, I like that. Where to go to? So Martin's formal music experience helped fill the gaps between the music, the Beatles' unrefined talent, and the sound which distinguished them from other groups, which eventually made them successful. After the huge success of the Beatles, Epstein found in Martin a willing customer to manage his acts. By 1963, their artist had dominated the pop charts and for the consecutive 37 weeks, and were even behind the bands who held the top three charts, including Billy J. Kramer, Jerry and the Peacemakers, and of course the Beatles. George Martin was also attributed to understanding the importance of supporting foreign markets and convinced the Beatles to re-release a couple of their singles in German. The boys, who had already been extremely successful singing in German at nightclubs in their native English. That makes sense? That didn't make, seem like it makes sense like that. Basically, they sang native English in German nightclubs and were extremely reluctant to record any translated material. They wouldn't take... Apparently, according to George Harrison, they wouldn't take my call. Finally, I drove to the hotel and barged in their room. Beatles ran in all directions, hiding behind sofas, cushions, the piano, anything that gave them cover.
Scatter.
Scatter.
So like Beatles.
Like True Bucks, yes. After rescheduling the session and recording a very lackluster version of...
come give me a Dinah hat.
Yeah, come give me... yeah. And She Leap Dick. Which convinced Martin that they were pretty much a waste of time. They were, as She Loves You, basically sounds like She Loves Dick. And if you do listen to it, it's like, She's the Dick. But yeah, I'm not going to play any Beatles stuff today. I was thinking about it, I just decided not to.
So what?
That, and also, you can listen to Beatles anytime. You know what I mean? They're kind of a band, we don't need to play their stuff. It's
just curious.
So... George Martin wanted to do those versions and they didn't. I can understand that.
I mean,
but they still decided to put them out, even if they were lackluster, which is strange.
CLSL, I guess.
Or was that just something that came later on a compilation or something?
No, I think those were released.
They did put them out.
Yeah. Half acid. Quarter acid. So George Martin would also consider himself an integral part of the Beatles' recordings, saying that he would sometimes play along with them, but most helps them arrange their songs and working generally with them. In a team, it was a team of five of us. We were fairly equal people in the studio. John was very famously demote Martin's role in the studio, saying that Martin was by no means the fifth Beatle. And if it were to, and it were where anyone were to be their manager, Brian Epstein, which I mean is a point there. He was definitely their buddy. He
yeah, helped. But was Brian Epstein in the studio with them?
Sometimes, but he also was the one who took a lot of their money. He was the one who made that deal. He didn't make that deal.
Yeah.
I said that in the midst of being scammed, so like he hadn't known any better at the time.
Well, you know, Brian Epstein dies in 67. That's how they don't have a manager anymore.
Oh, yeah.
And that's also around the time when they kind of gave up touring as well because he was getting sick and they said, fuck it, mostly George Harrison.
Yeah. And then it all fell apart.
Yeah, mostly. And again, that, man, I should really go look at that book. But that comic does a really good take on following Brian Epstein while he's sick, and then slowly one of the last chapters is he's sick in bed and the Beatles come in and they're like, you missed our album release party and here's Sergeant Pepper, and that's when he passes away after he hears or whatever, and he's like, this is fucking great, I took them to greatness or whatever. One prime example of where John diminishes Martin's efforts is the infamous Strawberry Fields recording session. After recording a multitude of versions of the song, John brought home the dailies, and the next day asked Martin to combine the two tracks into one. The two versions, which are semitone apart in pitch and were also played at different tempos, were combined with a new technique attributed to Martin known as the Very Speed. And we're going to get into some of his actual contributions here in just a sec. Now, I feel that John's attributes the idea to himself, because it is John quoted his saying, go on, you can fix it, to George Martin. So
John inspired him to fix it.
Yes.
John's idea.
That's bananas. That's mind blowing.
So also the fact that there's
the same recording technique.
Yeah. So there's, you know, the two full recordings of them semitoned apart pitched, and then there's also the orchestral version underneath that they've done as well. What's that fucking there's a couple of CDs I have. There's the anthology one, which has like different takes of other versions that are like mostly produced. And then my uncle, who owns a record shop, got me free CDs that's like all of the takes of all of the songs from Revolver, Rubber Soul, and Sgt. Pepper. And there's and I imagine Mystery Tour must be one also too, because I remember specifically there's this one take where they're doing Strawberry Fields. And they mess up going to the switch, and then you just hear Ringo keeping the beat, and they go, all right, lads, do it again, and they just, like, go back into the switch again, which I thought was really interesting.
36.
Yeah, because they didn't stop the song. They just kept going, which is, I don't know, something my music teacher taught me way back in, like, middle school. So even you fuck up, just keep the beat, you know what I mean? Because George can just snap it in half, you know what I mean? Or cut it out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Keep the tape rolling.
Yeah, exactly. Because tape is expensive. And that's also something behind Her Majesty, the one of the attributed first hidden tracks to a song.
Oh, yeah.
Of Abbey Road.
Yeah.
I think it was one of the engineers or some shit. He, you know, they just put the tape on. And he was told in his studies, like, never throw away tape. So he just put 5 seconds or 10 seconds of red tape or whatever it was. And Paul was like, keep it.
Yeah. Cool.
So yeah, now we are going to get into the meat of our episode, which is going to be some of the first attributed to George Martin. Like I said earlier, Very Speed, which is George Martin's signature wound-up piano recording, which he would do, at half speed in unison with the guitar, played a lower octave, and then speed it back up, basically.
This, I believe, is in the song In My Life.
Yes.
The interlude, there's a...
Yes.
He makes it sound like a harpsichord almost. But
yeah,
it's
exactly.
A piano, super fast.
Yeah, that's the thing, it's a super fast part. So
that was
slow
him
down half speed.
That was him playing as well.
Yes. And then, like, a lot of times, like, him with George Harrison, like, Hard Day's Night, that... That was half speed.
I forgot about that,
with the piano that they sped back up again. You know, Lovely Rita, In My Life, Baby It's You, even Misery. So that goes back to even the first albums. Those were tricks that he did long, way back then.
I didn't realize that.
One of my first things I ever learned about him, and one of my favorite things, is he is attributed... Now, I should say this again. These are not things that I'm going to say that he did first, but these are things that are attributed to him doing first. So I can't say that he definitely did this first. I guess he was the first white man who was attributed to it, I guess. So yes, he also was the first one to do the famous bass drum mic as well. It was the recording for Tomorrow Never Knows. Frustrated with the sound of the bass drum and wanting to capture a more powerful bass drum performance, he actually takes a knife and cuts a hole in the bass drum and breaks the rules of there's a distance you could have a mic to a drum set. And he broke the rule by putting it actually inside the drum kit. So he was the first one to put... He's attributed to be the first one to put the microphone.
Because they didn't... Did they not have holes in bass drums back then?
He cut a knife. He used a knife to cut a hole in that shit. So nice.
Direct action.
I need it louder.
Yeah.
More power.
Inside bass.
Put it in there.
I used to go to music lessons, and it was right next to Guitar Center. So I'd go in there sometimes before or after, and there was this one bass technician I used to talk to all the time, and he told me that. And that was one of the first things I was like, dude, George Martin's kind of fucking cool. Also, tape splicing and reverse tape effects. As mentioned earlier, Martin first developed this method using his comedy novelty recordings in the days of the Bridge Over the River Wye. Tape splicing became a common occurrence for the group during the middle, more psychedelic years, like Rain, Tomorrow Never Knows, I'm Only Sleeping, as well as some of the tape slicing you would hear in Strawberry Fields Forever and The Benefit of Mr. Kite. You guys know about The Benefit of Mr. Kite? How there's like the double-decker accordions, what are they? Harmonicas they use? There's this picture of them using like an old Telefunken microphone, and it's George and John, and they both George Harrison, that is, and they both have those like double, triple-decker harmonicas that they're... that whole part.
Oh, at the end?
Middle-ish. It's been a while since I've listened to the Beatles, to be honest. I would always say that they're my favorite band.
All time.
But I don't listen to them that much, honestly, anymore. I've been listening to a lot of Cowmen recently.
It's interesting. I've been I kind of grew up like not really listening to the Beatles that much, but I'm listening more and more. So, I mean, specifically just getting tunes together for gigs and stuff, but the more and more I listen to it, the more and more I find myself drawn to the songwriting.
Yeah.
Like, She's Leaving Home, I think that's one of the nicest songs.
Oh, yeah. I think that was one of the ones they won an award for.
Never, you know, it's one of the, what's the word I'm looking for? Well-written songs?
Yeah.
Because that was around the time that Paul started writing scores for music, in like 67 and stuff, and he was also working with George Martin as well. So he's attributed to doing double tracking. George Martin also had been attributed to the extremely useful technique of double tracking. The initial use was to double Lennon's vocals because John didn't like his own voice. This method was soon become widely used not only into the Beatles' future recordings, but also every major record studio to this day. Of course, like guitars and vocals and stuff. I don't know if you knew the story, but there was a Butch Vig who did Nevermind. Butch Vig, who did Nevermind?
I believe so.
And Butch Vig would always have to convince Kurt Cobain to sing again, because he was like, well, John Lennon did it. And I was like, all right, fine, I'll do it.
Yeah, isn't that the where they just kind of rolled up to the studio and played through twice, and the engineer expected to have like a whole weekend where they get like really fucking engineered, like the really meticulously get the sounds right, and
they just had
a completely different idea for they just literally came and played their set twice and was like, we like this one, let's go with this one. Convinced Kurt Cobain how to do the vocals, to double track the vocals. Yeah, he was like really not into it.
That's a pretty punk
attitude.
Because I know they weren't pleased with Butch Vig at the end, but I had not heard that story.
Really?
I've heard, they didn't like him. That's why they went with God, whoever did the fucking intro, because they were
Steve Albini.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was it him? Steve Albini did that one.
You can double check it if you want.
I can. I have my internet right here. If not, I'm pretty sure he mixed it. Yeah, no, Steve Albini did it. Shit. Goddamn, Steve Albini's everywhere, dude. So yes, he was the first one to do multi-tracking. Like, that was what I was gonna ask when I say, what do you guys think when I say multi-tracking? Because this one was a little confusing to me initially.
Well, I think I know where you're going with this, where you like record a band and then bust all that down into one track and record more tracks on top of it.
Well, that's where it goes eventually. Yeah. Because we talked about that one time.
Because that's what I think about when I hear think about multi-tracking. I know the Beatles made that a really popular technique.
So yeah, he did. Because I know for the longest time, up until about the Let It Be Abbey Road era, they had only a four track to work with. And of course, we also got to think that they're not recording onto a computer like we are. They actually are going on tape too. So one George Martin quote I got here is, I found that with the Beatles, when I was recording all the rhythm onto one track and all the voices all the voices onto the other, I needn't worry about losing the voices even if I recorded them at the same time. I could concentrate on getting all the really loud rhythm sound, knowing that I could always bring it up or down afterwards and make sure the voices were coming through. So they always recorded, you know, everyone kind of live during that time, but I think what the thing you attributed to him when they say multi-tracking is the fact that you go back on your recording and add more layers to it. I think that's what they're trying to say there. As well as the bouncing down technique, which I'll get to here in a sec.
I would think that was overdubbing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
When I think of multi-tracking, I just think of, you know, like we're doing right now, record four tracks at once.
At once, yeah.
But he definitely was one of the first to figure that out, like to crack the code of like, how do we cram this many instruments into, because they were using two-track tape or four-track tape.
Yeah.
How do we do this and actually make it sound good?
Yeah. So
early on,
the biggest thing like we're talking about now is bouncing down, is what he calls. There's a technique where he would, only with his four track, he would record on all four tracks, and then he would take that and put it into another single track of another four track. So you basically could make, what's that, a 16 track player if you want to. So that's a technique that he developed into was basically essential into the first multi-tracking recording studio. I have a little interesting quote here from him again. It was really difficult, but the only difficult thing here was to keeping him in your head and remembering what you had to do in the future. When you're bouncing one four track to another, you have to remember how much space you're going to lose and what the balance will be when the drums merge into the guitars, because once you did that, you're fixed. But that's just the discipline and experience of recording that made me do that. If it had been done on multi-track, it would have been a lot easier. So there he even says, if it had been done on multi-track, it would have been a lot easier. That's very interesting. Because that was one thing when I was writing this. I was definitely trying to piece together who I'd like to talk to about this and try to figure out. Because also the other thing is, I just don't understand how he'd be able to record a full band. And then was he always doing this technique? Because I feel like we'd always have to.
Well, the way I understand it is like maybe you get like a really good drum sound, or you get like a really good like band sound, and then once you get all that like EQ'd together, you get bust that down, and then you maybe like add like that's where you get crazy with like the string tracks and like adding layers and like like I don't know, like really orchestral.
So that makes more sense for the middle series, but I'm thinking of more of the really early stuff.
The early stuff.
Because here's the other thing too, before because. You know, they're famous for also kind of being one of the first bands to introduce like stereo sound as well. And you can buy their first five albums in stereo or mono, which is kind of interesting when I first.
Yeah, and the stereo ones, it's the instruments on the left and the vocals on the right.
Which I love that, but like.
It's so strange in headphones.
I mean, I fucking love that shit.
Yeah, it makes it like you can really hear what's going on in those vocal tracks if you're just listening to them, which is. It's kind of a luxury that we don't normally have. If you're trying to like pick apart a song and you know, learn the vocal parts, for example.
No, I know the Beatles did not like that at all. They were not fans of that because
it's
Paul
not very natural.
Yeah,
but Paul. It sounds good. That was the whole reason he did it. It was because he could get that separation and know that you don't lose the vocals.
But I don't know, just I was always trying to piece apart like how he did, I guess, the earlier ones with the drums and whatnot.
Like, it would have to be no more than two drum mics, and I would expect most of it's like just room, miking up the room with all the amps in it, and then they had a vocal mic. Like, you've seen the pictures of them singing on both sides of the vocal mic.
You usually see them. That's the other crazy thing, too, because they have to basically mix themselves on the vocal mic by who's standing close to who's standing far away from it, and X, Y,
and if
Z,
you
whatever.
Think if you think they knew how to do that, no, it was all George Martin.
That's the other thing,
figuring it out.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I think they might kind of dumb down what he did for them just because they didn't necessarily like all the things that they did for him at the time.
They didn't really understand what
what
he was doing for them.
Yeah, to me, he was kind of the fifth Beatle just musically in that aspect for recordings. Because I always considered, like, you know, the recording that you, as the band does, that is their recorded, finished version of a song. It's like, you know, that's going to be the one that lives on forever, obviously. So you need to find someone who does that well and, you know, brings the best you out.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, I guess it was kind of a shame they didn't appreciate that.
Do you happen to have the date on that John Lennon quote?
I don't. Wait. For which one? The Go On, You Can Fix It?
Yeah.
So that would have been the 67 when they're doing Strawberry Fields.
Oh,
that would have been
okay.
Daring It.
Okay.
But I know there was a lot of... he did, like, Playboy interviews, and a lot of that came out of those. I think there was the 1980 Playboy he did that lot of this stuff was taken from. But yeah, Brianna, so how's this going over your head right now?
I mean, it's going.
Okay.
Over my head, that is.
Okay, it's going over your head.
But... I mean, yeah, multi-tracking, it kind of speaks for itself from what you guys are saying in both ways. I could see people interpreting it either way.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on how you do your thing.
I guess, yeah.
It's no right answer.
So, this is kind of an interesting George Harrison quote. I'm going to try and do a George Harrison. Should I try and do a George Harrison? Now that we only play in the studios and not anywhere else, we've got less of a clue of what we're doing. Nobody knows the tunes sound like until they've recorded them and listened to them afterwards.
That's very true.
I was better. So, yeah, the reason I wanted to do this episode is kind of talk about why we do what we do. The main reason of River City Sounds podcast is to capture the sound of live bands. Like I was saying earlier about, you know, the bands having their own perfect recorded version, I also think it's very important for the history context to record bands and what they sound like live, because, you know, sometimes it can be different what they recorded, you know, the way they perform it or just the pieces to it or XYZ, to help preserve kind of the live bands of Richmond during this time, and also help provide a platform to promote local music as well, so that it can be, you know, promoted in other aspects besides just going to a show that some people have to pay for and might not want to. Because it's really nice when we have bands who come in here and have never recorded or just doing demos and stuff, and they give some experience to, you know, have that experience of what it's like to record, or maybe they, you know, maybe want to release it as a little live EP or something like that, which is always welcome and fun to do. Another thing I like to do is make limits for myself as well. I really do admire George Martin and his aspect to be able to overcome a lot of the limits that he had during his time. And one of the things I would like to do is give time and recording limits to create a more authentic atmosphere for the live, you know, aspect of what we're doing. Sometimes bands want to do a little bit more, which is fine, but I'm not trying to make a real overproduced effort. Does that make sense?
It's live.
It makes total sense to me.
Yeah.
Live.
Yeah, basically. I want it to be nice enough that you can, you know, maybe want to release it as your own thing if you want to get it mastered or mix it a little farther than what Zach here does. But, I don't know. I just feel like sometimes that needs to be explained, and I don't like having to explain that sometimes in the middle of a thing. I don't want to, like, break your, I don't know, shimmy your parade, whatever it may be. But also, I've talked to Jono before about this. I don't know if I've talked to you about this or not, Zach, but one of my things is that I don't like identifying myself as a producer in a lot of ways. I actually met somebody at my work who saw my alien tattoo. Did I tell you guys the story? And he thought it was alien software, and he was like, oh, do you produce? And I was like, well, that's not what that is, but I mean, I kind of do. And that was like talked all day about producing. It just kind of went over my head for some things, because there's a lot of terminology I don't necessarily always understand. A great George Martin quote here: today there's so much competition. There's so many records, and they're so good that you have to have a combined forces assault from all directions, land, sea, and air. You've really got to go for television, you've got to go for radio, you've got to go for advertising on buses, and even that poster, and so on. It really is a massive thing to do now, to break someone new. Which I think is really funny that he still is thinking, like, radio and television. And that was, like, in the 90s, too, when he said that as well.
Oh.
Which I thought was interesting. No, he lived pretty long. I think he
That's
lived.
True, yeah.
And then his son definitely took over, too, because they both produced the Love album, the live Cirque du Soleil type
thing that
they did as well.
When was that?
2006, I think. Okay. That's just the number I have in my head right off the top. Here's another George Martin quote. When I started in this business, there were probably only about 12 people like me in the entire country making records. And that's in England, but still. Now that seems like every third person I meet is a record producer, or at least trying to be one. So the whole thing has become much more of a much more pervasive. I was lucky to be there at the beginning. Therefore, it's been very difficult for starting at the bottom and working your way up now. I'd be horrified if I had to have done it now. Love that fucking quote.
Do you have a date on that one?
That, again, was by the same person, same time period in the mid-90s or so.
In the 90s.
Which is thinking this is like...
Pre-laptop producer.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So, exactly. Mind blown. Because that's right around the time when, like, laptop producing is, like, bedroom pop starting to kind of get its seeds.
Yeah.
Get its roots in there and whatnot. I do want to end...
It's definitely a poignant quote, though.
Yes. Some good quotes in there, yeah? So I do want to end this here. What happened? So yeah, we're going to end here with a little bit more of Beatles George Martin's history. So by mid-1969, the Beatles had realized the disaster that was the Get Back sessions, and it once again returned George Martin to produce their final effort, which was Abbey Road. We agreed on one condition, that he be allowed to exercise authority over the group's whims. The Beatles would return to record the leftover of Let It Be and would release the world-acclaimed Abbey Road. George Martin would acquire the unfinished Let It Be, recorded by Phil Spector. So you guys are aware that Phil Spector did record Let It Be for the most part. He was the producer for that.
I did not realize that.
Yes. I didn't know that. George Martin would then acquire the unfinished Let It Be, recorded by Phil Spector, and then mixed the album for release. That's not very specific, but I think what I'm trying to say is that George Martin mixed for the actual release. But the thing is, it was already kind of mixed by Phil Spector, kind of what you and me do a little bit, where I give it a little light mixing, and you kind of take it from there. But the later remix by Spector before its release, so it was remixed three times in total, back and forth. George Martin does not receive credit on the album and is said that I produced the original, and what should be in the credit is saying, produced by George Martin, overproduced by Phil Spector. Which is, I love that so much. Last thing, one of my favorites, that little known song called You Know My Name, Look Up the Number. You guys familiar with the single?
Yes.
It's the last Beatles single. It's like 8 minutes long. It's just kind of a weird cabaret kind of song. It was recorded in 1967. It's so good, though. It's just, you know my name, look up the number, sang in different ways to like over like different cabaret beats. And there's like audience in the background and stuff.
Fun.
And it's like, now introducing, I don't know the name, Jimmy Savile or whatever. It's like, boom.
Holy
boom,
shit.
Boom.
Deep that out. Yeah.
No, you're fine.
Yeah.
We swear. I might not swear this time. Anyways, but the track was recorded in 1967. It was actually one of the last recordings of Brian Jones, Yes.
What?
He played saxophone on it.
Oh.
He played the saxophone. That was one of his last recordings before he passed away, apparently. But that was actually the last Beatles recording session with John and Paul. They did that in 1969. They did the little cabaret vocals in the background of it. And that's all I have. I appreciate you guys being here. All
right.
Good stuff. Feel informed.
If we could end on anything, it'd be that one.
You guys want to jam?
What was that?
What was that? If I play bass.
Sorry?
If I play bass.
Sure.
Just some water. You're great.
Hey there, Cole here once more again. Just wanted to make some further points to clarify some of the things we had talked about in this episode today. While researching the recording of Come give me your hand, and she loves dick. Now, unfortunately, she leaped dick would have to be completely re-recorded because they'd accidentally erased the mono masters during the original days. Fortunately, Come Give Me Your Hand only had to have the vocals re-recorded. It was during this research I was able to find out that George Martin had actually been using his bouncing down technique ever since the beginning days of the Beatles back in 1963. It was said that the original mix of I Wanna Hold Your Hand had actually had four rhythm tracks that had been bounced down to two tracks so that the vocals had the other two. So this was a long-held technique that George Martin used for all the Beatles history. However, I would like to note that the first four or five of the Beatles albums had all been released as mono. You can now retroactively go back and buy those as stereo recordings, which is interesting because they were recorded, you know, thought to be mono. So sometimes the mixing that they do on those are so harsh that you can actually hear where some of the placement of the instruments has gone, as well as can hear all the other instruments being picked up on the other tracks because they're usually being played completely live. Also, I mentioned a comic book that I had considered using on a Brian Epstein piece. We may not do that one because that would probably be our only source, but that one is indeed called The Fifth Beatle. It's really quite good, and if you were interested in Brian Epstein and his history and what he did to help the Beatles, I would very highly recommend buying and reading that comic. Now, that is by Vivek Tiwari. I'll spell that. It's V-I-V-E-K-T-I-W-A-R-Y. I also want to note our sources once again because I feel like I mumbled through them a little bit in the beginning. We have The Long and Winding Road, An Intimate Guide to the Beatles by Ted Greenwald. We have The Beatles, Every Little Thing by Maxwell McKenzie. We have The Little Book of the Beatles, Quips and Quotes from the Fab Four by Seven Oaks Books. There's no author there. And finally, we have Meet the Beatles Again by Kenny Sharp and Denny Somach. Thanks to the tremendous response we got from our first history episode, and hopefully, if this one goes well, we have a bunch more for you that we have lined up that we can fill in the spaces between our regularly scheduled programming. I appreciate you guys listening. Once again, this was Cole, and we also had with us Brianna, Jono, and Zach. I do want to make one last correction, and that is the fact that You Know My Name, Look Up the Number, is not 8.5 minutes long. It's about half that. It's about 4:20. And I would like to end this by playing that. So, see you around.
You know my name. You know my name? Ba-ba-ba-bum. Look up the number. You know my name? Look up the number. You know my name, baby. You know my name. You know my name.
The man.